My name is Andre Hessen. I am a graduate student at MIT, and I today will be talking about the power of ZX Calculus and how we can use this to compile quantum codes. So once again, yeah, thank you for inviting me. So I work in quantum computing and quantum information at MIT, working with Peter Shor. And I want to acknowledge some people who have worked on this sort of stuff with me. So in this work, anything that you see relating to graphs, I have worked on with Kevin Wren and Alex Hu, and the ZX work with Peter Shor and Jonathan Liu, and the archive identifiers are there. I am also doing ongoing work, some of which is somewhat present here with Alex Lee. And throughout this talk, I will occasionally write, ask me about this. If I want to share more about a certain subject, but cut it out for purposes of time. But if you have questions or you find that exciting, you're welcome to ask me about like this ongoing work or other things that will appear later. Okay. So in this talk, I'm going to motivate a problem in quantum code representation, explain the downsides of the commonly used solutions, introduce ZX Calculus and showcase some of its uses, and finally solve this original problem using ZX. And so, but all of this is a whole bunch of words. My big goal is to change the language that we use to discuss quantum codes. There are various ways that we use to discuss quantum codes, and I think ZX Calculus is far superior. My goal will be to convince you of this by the end of the talk, and hopefully get people talking about codes using ZX Calculus. So if you have seen ZX Calculus before, perhaps you're already convinced of this. If not, hopefully you soon will be. And if you haven't seen this before, then I can spare you the brainwashing of other quantum code languages. Okay, so a brief introduction to quantum error correcting codes. A poll of the room shows that everyone seems to be familiar is that we wish to transmit some quantum state in the presence of noise. Here is an example of a two-qubit state that we might want to transmit. You know, these are zeros and ones. The noise is usually represented by Pauli matrices. It's a random Pauli noise, okay. The generic problem with, and it's gone. Okay, well. All right. I can see the bright white light. Anyway, so we want to copy quantum information, but we cannot. So the standard solution is that we can add redundancy to our qubits by using entanglement. Peter Shor came up with the first quantum error correcting code in 1995, the 9-qubit code. And this encodes 1 qubit into 9 and can correct any single qubit error. Great. Background stuff out of the way. So here is an innocuous question that might appear at the end of sort of an introductory class in quantum computing on an exam. Depict Shor's 9-qubit code. And there is no single unique answer to this question. There are several. Here is what I see as the sort of the three most common answers that we might see to this question. So we have from left to right, the stabilizer tableau presentation, the code words themselves, and a circuit that encodes it. So I want to go over each of these potential solutions and what their upsides and downsides are. So here are the code words for the Shor code using bras and kets. Okay, great. Well, the pros is it tells you exactly what you're getting. These are the code words of the code. Great, you know exactly what they are. No questions about that. The presentation of the code is unique. There's sort of only one way to write that down. There's a bit of an asterisk here because, we'll get to that in a moment. The nice part about this is, well, the Shor code is compact. It is easy to express the Shor code using this nice compact notation I have at the top of the page. The cons are that, well, how do I construct this? Like, sure, these are my code words. How do I build them or build them efficiently? How do I then decode? How do I recover? What is the entanglement structure? That is another question I'm going to ask several times. Which qubits are entangled with which other qubits? Now, of course, the whole thing is entangled and, you know, all together, but there is definitely a sense in which some qubits are more similar to other qubits because, let's say, they were entangled directly near the end of my map, for example. Or perhaps sometimes if I have a more complicated code, maybe because I made some mistake or maybe because I just wanted it that way, I have two sets of inputs that don't actually get entangled anywhere in the encoding process. It would be relatively tricky to see that if I just wrote out the entire state vector. And the second and much more glaring con is, well, here are the code words for the 5-qubit code.
Ah!
They're so long. It takes exponential space to write this down, of course. This is the main problem. Now, we don't need exponential space if we want to work with a Clifford code, but that is why this presentation is not ideal. Okay, maybe the circuit diagram will help. So, we know how to construct the code if we have a circuit diagram. That is certainly a big upside. This is the circuit diagram for the short code on the right-hand side. We have a circuit diagram, we know how to build the circuit, great, we have the short code. And this also tells you what you're getting. It's relatively easy to simulate the circuit, run it forward, and figure out what you get on the other side. It even gives you kind of a partial recipe for a recovery map, because it is certainly the case that if you experience no errors, you can simply run the circuit in reverse and you can recover your message. If you do experience errors, you have to sort of fix them first, but most of the recovery map is kind of built for you. The recipe is partial. And we can even see some of the entanglement structure. Right here, we can see that, oh, okay, we took, you know, the first qubit and we did some controlled knots with qubits 4 and 7, and then each of those, you know, did something with the qubits next to it. Great, okay. So we can see that some of the entanglement structure, and certainly if I had a second copy of this whole circuit here, and I was using the short code twice to encode 2 qubits into 18, it would be pretty clear that there are no gates, like the controlled NOT gates, that cross the gap in the middle, therefore the top half is independent from the bottom half and they're not entangled. That would be visible in the circuit. Downsides, not unique. Well, some people don't care about this fact too much, but when you are trying to compare to see if you've seen something before, if it's similar to something else, it is good for something to have sort of a common language with which people use to talk about it, and in particular when it's easy to compare these things. And a circuit is most certainly not unique. There are many, many, many ways to express the same thing in a circuit, and even many ways to express the same thing compactly, because qubits 4 and 7 are not special, right? Like, I could have had this first controlled NOT gate go to qubit 5 and then had, like, basically permute the order of the middle 3 wires or the bottom 3 wires. That wouldn't have changed anything. And this brings me to my next point, which is that you can have these be arbitrarily long. I can keep, you know, stacking various things into the circuit, and while I can't make the bras and kets more complicated than they already are, I could make the circuit arbitrarily long. Now, we can try to compile a circuit. There are many people that work on circuit compilation, but at the end of the day, there's still many ways to draw a very long circuit. And lastly, that the identical qubits in the short code look asymmetric. If we go back to the bras and kets on the previous page, we have this 000 plus 111 to the third power. It is immediately clear from at least that compact form that qubits 1, 2, and 3 are the same. They are exactly the same, like we could permute them and nothing would change. This is useful to know when looking at how to decode the code. You know, the same is true for qubits 4, 5, and 6. Here, qubit 1 looks way more special than qubit 2, and yet they're the same. So how come? So this is probably the one that a lot of people are ready to jump up and defend, because this is sort of the commonly accepted good one. The stabilizer presentation, right, it only takes quadratic space. It is nice and compact. It is only ever this size. This is the one for the short code. It kind of tells you the construction, sort of. You know that if you measure all of these things on some arbitrary state and get, you know, plus one each time, what you have constructed is going to be a code word of your code. But to get that plus one result, your circuit, you kind of need to almost build post-selection into it. You need to get the plus one result. If you get the minus one result, what do you do? I mean, you can apply some correcting operator, but that's extra steps. So the construction has a bit of an asterisk for it. The best part about the stabilizer presentation, credit where credit is due, is that it definitely tells you how to measure and then correct any errors. This is by far the best feature that it has. Cons. Once again, the entanglement structure, I think, is quite poor. If I had various parts of the stabilizer tableau, it would be a little unclear as to how they were related. Now, I could have a very nice stabilizer tableau. If I, for example, had a tableau where here I had some big matrix, and then here I had a whole bunch of identity matrices, and then I had another identity matrix here, and then I had some other matrix here, then yes, I have two parts here. The two stabilizers are clearly talking about two separate clumps of qubits that are not related at all. But then I could do arbitrary row operations and permute these. Now you might say, why would I want to? That just makes it worse. But suppose it was handed to me this way by a student answering the question that I posed on a test. Maybe the student is being cheeky. So, and that is, of course, not the only scenario where I might imagine having a stabilizer that is not immediately sort of separated this way. So the entanglement structure is not great. And even within each clump that is connected, there's still, it leaves something to be desired. Furthermore, the identical qubits still look asymmetric. Now, in this case, maybe it's easy enough to see that the, let's say, the top two rows, ZZI and IZZ, you know, you can multiply them together, get ZIZ. Clearly, the qubits 1, 2, and 3 are the same for all intents and purposes, but this is more difficult to do if the rows had been permuted previously somewhat. So as I mentioned before, a con is that the construction, at least the natural one, so to speak, involves post-selection. There are other ways to construct it. And this not uniqueness is my biggest sticking point against the stabilizer presentation, because assuming that I did all my math right, that is another answer to our original question. This is yet another stabilizer for the tableau for the short code. I took some random basis for the same subspace of these rows, and I got this result. And here, a lot of these questions about like which qubits are entangled with which other qubits, which qubits are identical, become a lot harder to answer as soon as it's, you know, a little bit shuffled around like this. Okay. So there are other presentations than the three that I have mentioned so far. I mentioned what I see as the most common ones, the ones that I would think most people would naturally jump to, the ones that are taught in most classes. You know, Tanner graphs are nice, but they're for CSS codes mostly. We can use graphs to express states in other ways, and this is something I'm happy to talk about more at great length. We have surface codes that give us nice visuals and express things nicely, like the toric code and so on. But if our question is, how do we generalize that to an arbitrary code, not a CSS code, not a surface code, but an arbitrary code, a lot of these methods fall short. So because I hyped it up so much, it was in the title of this talk, there's clearly this moment where I'm going to say, and now, you know, I'm going to show the ultimate answer to the problem using ZX calculus, but that would be jumping the gun. That will come at the end of the talk. I promise to deliver on the way the ZX calculus expresses the short code, but that will come later. So what is ZX calculus? This is something that we have to go through first. So this is going to be a brief introduction to ZX calculus covering the fundamentals. It all fits on one slide, or at least the very basics. Everything else, the first principles, fits on one slide. So ZX calculus is made of spiders. Spiders are just a cute name for nodes in a tensor network. And there are just two types of spiders, Z spiders and X spiders. So these are going to align with our familiar definitions of poly X and poly Z, not in that order. So these are drawn as green and red nodes, respectively. So green nodes are Z nodes, and red nodes are X nodes. They have a single phase. This is the main difference between ZX calculus and a completely generic tensor network. An arbitrary tensor, like a vector or a matrix or a larger tensor, can have a zillion different parameters, making it very difficult to work with them in the general case. Nodes in ZX calculus have just one parameter, an angle or a phase, which will often denote alpha. And because so often this parameter will be zero, we will just leave it blank if it is zero. This makes them a lot easier to work with. Now, it does mean that, like, you know, you can't express an arbitrary circuit using a single node like you would be able to with a single tensor, for example, because a circuit isn't just a big tensor. But you can work with them in other more convenient ways. Just like in a normal tensor network, if you have two nodes connected by an edge, that means you are taking the inner product along that edge between those two tensors, and you can sort of contract the network along that edge. So, another thing about specifically ZX calculus is that it's going to ignore all scalar factors. If we are ever finding ourselves multiplying the entire diagram by a factor of 2 or 1 over root 2 or anything else like that, we are going to ignore that. Unless that number is 0, in which case everything breaks. But anything other than 0, we are going to ignore it. And this is also something that I'm happy to talk more about if anyone has any questions. So, what is such a spider? I haven't actually said any math yet. What do we do? If it has n input legs and m output legs, it looks like this. So we have a green spider and a red spider here. The n inputs get mapped to these m outputs. So we see that the green spider maps the all zero state to the all zero state and the all one state to the all one state with a phase. Now, this is not unitary. There are lots of states that sort of, you know, it doesn't map to anything at all and that get completely canceled out. It also does not have the same number of inputs and outputs. There is nothing about this that is in any way meant to look unitary. It is an arbitrary tensor. It could be a projector or like it's an arbitrary size tensor. And it takes the superposition of these two maps. This is the Z node that works in the Z basis, and the X node does exactly the same thing in the X basis. Over here, I have drawn in yellow, a little yellow box with an H. That is the Hadamard gate. It is a specific type of object. It can be built out of a green node with phase pi over 2, a red node with phase pi over 2, something like that. Like, using three Euler angles, you can get an arbitrary single qubit rotation. But because the Hadamard gate is so useful, it is not an atom, but I am going to repeatedly draw Hadamard gates or constructions that involve Hadamard gates because they're going to be everywhere. But they can be expressed using the other nodes. So I think in this form, writing down what the spiders mean in this form is a little bit confusing. I think it is easier to look a little bit beyond this. So I think the nicer way of writing down what the nodes look like is like this. So the green nodes are this tensor, and the red nodes are this one. And plus and minus have the common definitions up on the screen. So notice here I didn't even bother numbering how many input legs and output legs there are, because at the end of the day, the difference between a bra and ket isn't actually that significant. It's just like sort of a, you project among all of your incident legs simultaneously. And you know, you take the superposition of the all zeros projection with the all ones projection. The difference between a bra and a ket becomes a little bit moot until you try to extract some meaning from your network. So let's do some kind of basic examples. Here are the most basic building blocks that we can have. If we have a node with no incident edges that is going to turn into a scalar, regardless of whether or not you have a green node or a red node, if you have no phase and no incident edges, then if we look at the definition, we'll just see that we're going to have 1 plus e to the I 0. This works out to 2. Scalar factors are ignored, so we get 1. If, however, we had a phase of pi, we'll get, instead of 1 plus e to the I 0, we'll get 1 plus e to the I pi, which works out to 0. So having any of these in your diagram kills the whole diagram, makes it all irrelevant, makes it all 0. OK, if we have a node with a single output and no inputs, that is just a 1 qubit state. And in particular, the green node corresponds to a plus, which is counterintuitive because it is a Z node, and yet it provides a plus, which is, you know, an eigenvector in the X basis. And the red node is a 0. Why is that? Well, if we look at the definition again, we'll see that the green node is ket 0 plus e to the I 0, so plus 1 times ket 1, which is a plus. So that is why this produces a plus, even though it's green. And for the same reason, this produces a 0, because it is plus plus minus. So a green node with a single in output was a plus qubit, but a green node with a single input is a plus post-selected measurement. So this is not something that we're allowed to generically include willy-nilly, like, oh yes, and this is going to work out to be a plus. But it is nevertheless going to be very useful to remember that we can post-select if we need to, and more on that in a moment. So the basic rules give rise to more complicated rules. These are not additional rules. These are emergent properties. But we can treat them sort of like rewrite rules because they make things very convenient. You can bask in this slide if we want. I promise we're not going to use all of these things today. And these are kind of like the Rademeister moves for knots that allow us to change and rewrite a various diagram. There's a few of these that I want to draw your attention to. So over here, this is just saying that if we have two nodes that are of the same color, and all of these rules hold true if you invert all the colors from green to red. If you have two nodes of the same color and that are connected, you can contract along those edges and add the phases. Already, this makes this tensor network way easier to work with than a generic tensor network. The fact that they have a single parameter that just adds like this very nicely gives you a lot of simplicity when you are manipulating the diagram. Over here, this rule, if you have two Hadamards in a row, they cancel, easy enough. The Hadamard gate is its own inverse. This one says if you have a node that has a Hadamard gate on every single incident edge, you can change the basis of that node from green to red and vice versa. Because, of course, the Hadamard gate is the basis change from Z to X. And the last rule that I'll actually work with today, these four can be ignored, is this identity rule here. It is exactly like, very conveniently, I have drawn the diagram at the perfect time. It is exactly like this node that has a pi phase on it, but with zero phase. If I have zero phase here, this e to the I pi term goes away, and I just have a coefficient of one, making this the identity matrix. So the rule is, if I have a node with zero phase and exactly two incident edges, I can remove that node. That is the rule. So the four rules to remember. Hadamard gate cancels with itself. Hadamard gate is basis change. Nodes can contract along edges, phases add, and I can remove the identity nodes this way. So let's construct a bell pair as a simple thing that we can do with the circuit. So what's the normal circuit for constructing a bell pair? Start with two qubits initialized both to the state 0. I apply a Hadamard gate to, let's say, qubit 1. And then I apply a controlled X gate with qubit 1 as the control. So this is the ZX calculus depiction of the circuit. I start with two qubits, both in the state 0. That is the red node with one output edge. I apply a Hadamard gate to the first qubit. And then this construction here, this very, very, very simple construction, is the controlled NOT gate. Green node is control, red node is target. That is it. That is a controlled NOT gate. Now, notice the vertical edge. I am not clarifying whether or not this edge is an input or an output of the green, or an input of the green node or an output of the red node, or vice versa, because it doesn't matter. It is a tensor network, and only the topology of the network matters. The geometry is completely irrelevant. The math is completely the same whether or not you treat this edge as being an input of this and an input of this, if you want to like bend it to the left or, you know, output input. It does not matter at all. It's a tensor network. So let's apply the rewrite rules that we learned just a moment ago. This node here has a Hadamard gate on all the incident edges, so we're going to change its color to green. Then these two nodes are of the same color and connected, and these two nodes are also the same color and connected. And we're going to merge them and add their phases, and we're going to do this complicated mathematical operation here. So we get this. And then lastly, we have phase zero nodes with exactly two incident edges. Both this one and this one are phase zero with two incident edges. So this is what a bell pair looks like in ZX calculus. And I think that's quite beautiful. And once we start to think about this, it starts to make a little more sense as to why we're representing it this way and why we're ignoring scalars. Remember that the identity matrix is just looks like this without the e to the I pi, right? Ket 0 bra 0 plus ket 1 bra 1. Whereas a bell pair, again, ignoring the scalar, is exactly the same thing it's exactly the same as if you take this and you flip all of the bras to kets. Ket 0 0 plus ket 1 1. And that is the same as what you get when you take the identity wire and you change all the bras to kets by making all the inputs point right. Okay. So this is the standard circuit for quantum teleportation expressed in ZX calculus. We are currently located here in the Bob room. But if we have Alice and Bob start out with their bell pair over here, we have Alice measure in the bell basis, which she does by undoing the bell pair construction by starting with a controlled NOT gate. Notice that this is the control. And then undoing the Hadamard gate that originally constructed the bell pair. She can then measure. She is measuring in the Z basis, which comes with a red node, because remember that the when we have a node with a single input and no outputs, if it's red and has zero phase, that is a post-selected zero measurement. And if it has a phase of pi, that is a post-selected one measurement. And by labeling these alpha pi and beta pi, what we're saying is we don't know what Alice gets. She gets either 0 or pi, but she definitely gets one of those two. She is making a measurement. She is projecting. So in this case, alpha and beta are both either 0 or 1. And this is important. So alpha and beta are both either 0 or 1. Then, once those measurements happen, she then phones Bob and says, Bob, you know, here's alpha and beta. Bob then applies the right recovery operations. Bob applies either the identity or Z, depending on the value of beta. That is another very elegant way that we can have Bob to apply something conditional. Because if beta is 0, this has it's a node with phase 0 and two incident edges. We remove it. And if beta is equal to 1, that has phase pi, which is just a Z gate. So it's exactly what we want Bob to do. This does the same thing, but for X. And now, assuming this works, I'm going to show you how we can simplify this. These two nodes at the top have the same color and are connected by an edge, so we merge them. The node in the middle row has a Hadamard on every single incident edge, so it changes color to green. Then, these green nodes are connected, so we merge those as well. These green nodes are connected, so we're merging those, and we're adding the phases to get 2 beta pi. And the key here is that beta is either 0 or 1, so this is either 0 or 2 pi. And since the phase is an angle, that means the phase is just 0. And it's a node with phase 0 and exactly 2 incident edges. So we're going to remove that as well. And then we're going to do the same thing with the other two nodes. They merge to make 2 alpha pi, and we can remove it too. And in the end, this is the much neater, in my opinion, explanation of the fact that quantum teleportation allows Alice to move her qubit over to Bob's side, assuming that they start with a Bell pair. The typical explanation of quantum teleportation that we see in an introductory quantum class will require writing out the state vector at every sort of stage of the process and then saying, well, suppose Alice gets like this pair of measurements, and then you show that what recovery map Bob applies, and then you say, and the other three cases are analogous. Whereas this, I find, is the much more intuitive explanation. So one more time, this is the, oh, there. This is the whole process summarized. And over from here to here, there was a very subtle trick. There was some sleight of hand, which is that what we did was we turned the kind of the backwards S-like pattern of the diagram into something that looks a lot more straightforward without needing to go forward and then back. Now, I did say it's a tensor network and only the topology matters, and this is an allowed operation, so it's actually fine. I didn't lie. But it is a very subtle distinction that this looks like a wire from Alice to Bob. And what we had before, the backwards S-like thing, is actually Alice and Bob start with a Bell pair, and then Alice takes her, you know, half the Bell pair in her state, and she kind of post-selects on the Bell pair in the Bell basis measurement, and that transmits her state to Bob, which is true. And it's very elegant that you can just yank the wire and make that work. Okay. So let's get into some of the really powerful stuff that you can do with ZX Calculus. So a lot of the things we've been working with, a lot of the objects, nodes and edges, in my opinion, make me at least think of graphs. Here is the best graph. This is the best example graph. It's called the house graph. It looks like a house. Great. It's got a 3-cycle, it's got a 4-cycle, it's got everything. So there are specific quantum states that are called graph states. These are all Clifford states, and here are their definitions in sort of the three familiar languages. You know, you can pick whichever one you prefer. You can think, well, if you have a graph G with a set of vertices and edges, then you initialize a kind of a plus qubit for every vertex. You apply controlled Z onto the pair of vertices corresponding to every edge in the graph. The controlled Z gate is symmetric on its two inputs, so that makes sense because so are edges. Controlled Z gates are diagonal, so they all commute. So this is also well-defined. The order in which you apply these does not matter. Great. We have a definition of a graph state. As a circuit, that looks just about the same. Initialize every qubit in a plus by starting with 0 and then Hadamarding it. Apply controlled Z gates on every single edge pair. Now, the stabilizer tableau is one of the more elegant ways to look at this. This takes the adjacency matrix of the graph, the symmetric adjacency matrix, and puts a Z on every single node where that adjacency, or every single cell where that adjacency matrix has a 1, and then puts an X on the diagonal. And that is the stabilizer tableau for the graph. OK, great. Can anyone guess what the graph looks like in ZX Calculus? Well, I'm going to spoil it. Well, so in ZX Calculus, a plus is just a green node with a single output, and controlled Z is two green nodes connected by a Hadamarded edge. I'm going to note this edge as blue and dashed. If you see an edge that is blue and dashed, that just means it's a normal edge that it has a Hadamard gate in the middle of it. But I don't want to draw too many Hadamard gates, so instead the edges are going to be blue and dashed. At one point they might just be just blue, but still, if it's blue, it has a Hadamard gate on it. Furthermore, using another rule that we can derive from the building blocks of ZX Calculus, double edges cancel. So this truly is like toggling an edge. You add a controlled Z gate, you add this dashed blue edge, and if you have two Hadamarded edges between these two green nodes, you can cancel both of them. So it's like the controlled Z gate turning on the edge or turning it off. So this is what the house graph looks like in ZX Calculus. It's exactly the same graph. All the edges are Hadamarded, except that every node now has a single edge coming out of it, which is the output edge. Why do we have an output edge? Because a 5-qubit state is just kind of like a circuit with no inputs and 5 outputs. So hence, every node produces an output edge. And so then you can take these 5 qubits and plug them into whatever you wanted to use your 5-qubit state with. And this is what the exact same thing that we get if I simply arrange the vertices from top to bottom. Here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are vertex labels. They are not phases. Apologies for any confusion. Great. So OK, that's neat and elegant. What can we use this for? Well, the big idea is that we can get any Clifford state by adding operations to the output edges. So I mentioned that only some Clifford states are graph states, but we can get any Clifford state if we just add one of these 6 operations. And these are what these operations look like in ZX calculus, a very small set. These 4 over here, which are multiples of the phase gate, are just done by adding some phase to the node. So all, for all of these nodes, you can imagine that there's edges sort of coming into it from other points in the graph. I'm just looking at the node and its corresponding output edge, but all these nodes are connected to other parts of the graph. These are not states, or at least not supposed to represent states. They could be if the graph only has like a single vertex and an edge coming out, if it's just a single qubit state. So to put a Hadamard gate on an output edge, we just make the output Hadamarded edge blue, and then a Hadamard and a ZK as, well, the Z is on the node as a green pi, and there's a blue edge coming out. So there is one, so already this is expressive enough. Just these 6 operations on the output edges of any graph state, these are some of the local Clifford operations. Clifford operations you can get without needing to apply something like controlled NOT gates, are good enough to generate any Clifford state. But we can go further. There is a complicated graph operation that we can do that allows us to take any h that is located on a vertex and move it on the output edge of a vertex and move it onto the output edge of any neighboring vertex. This comes at the cost of toggling a bunch of edges in the graph. What this means is that if we can then cancel it with another h that's potentially there, or we can sort of move it to a lower numbered node. And so the theorem that Alex Hu and I proved is that states have a unique canonical form where no h can be moved down, and it is expressed using the operations above. So if you can't move an h to a lower numbered node, you keep moving them as much as you can. As soon as you can't do it anymore, you stop. You have reached that state's canonical form, and that is unique. This comes with a whole bunch of great parallels. For example, the fact that you can just keep moving it down, and then when you can't, you stop, means that you can do it greedily, because you can't possibly reach a bad end result, because there's a unique form. So if you keep moving it down, you'll keep like improving your heuristic. Yay, the h's are lower, they're lower, they're lower, and oh, I stop, and because I can't go any further. So you can do it in any order. It's great. You'll always reach this canonical form. You can do this efficiently. Yes?
Sorry, when you say lower, do you mean like you just labeled the?
Yes, yes. The vertices are labeled.
So you can pick any labeling, and then there's a unique like canonical form with respect to that labeling?
Yes, with respect to that labeling, yes, that's right. I mean, already we, in many cases, treat like if I have a circuit and I have the same circuit with a swap gate applied at the end, we would say those are different circuits. They you know, they're different unitary transformations. So there's always a sense of we're labeling all of our outputs. And so with respect to a labeling, there is a unique canonical form where the state is expressed as a graph with these 6 potential local operations where the h's cannot be moved to lower numbered nodes. So no h is on a vertex that is connected to a lower numbered vertex. Yes?
When you use this greedy algorithm to, mm-hmm. to the canonical form, if you start in like a simple looking, I mean, it could be that the number of edges is like increasing or something as this goes on. Like,
I did say that we're toggling some edges, but we are only toggling edges that are like internal to the graph. And yes, it is true that the canonical form is not the form with the fewest edges. But we think that is a price that we are willing to pay because of the niceness of the presentation. And
have you used it for circuit simulation, like when you do updates with local gates?
So indeed, that is sort of my next slide, which is that circuits are states. They are exactly the same thing as states because you know, by your favorite one of these three things. You can turn the wires around or turn the bras into kets, or you can try to pronounce that. But a circuit is a state, and so this immediately gives us a canonical form for Clifford circuits as well, and it gives us a compiler. If we can build this state efficiently, then we can sort of canonically simplify all these things into get your canonical form for any Clifford circuit using this. Does that answer your question?
I guess maybe not quite. So like if I have, let's say I give you a Clifford circuit and I want
okay.
to simulate it using stabilizer formalism,
mm-hmm.
I could maintain a representation of the state at
yep.
a point in time
yep.
that is the one from the previous slide.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would have to use some update rules at every step.
Yep.
And so I guess what I'm wondering is, have you compared that to other Clifford simulation methods?
Yeah, the asymptotically they have the same speed, I think, that they're quadratic. So, but yes, we have done that, and we have written out a way to do these update rules. This is a thing I'll touch on briefly now. Let's see if I can get this to, okay. When the state is represented this way, it is relatively easy to simulate the effect of additional local operations. For example, if my local operation on a node is one of these four, and I add some, like the Clifford operation I want to apply to my state now, maybe it's the next gate in the circuit, is just like an S, then I just change the phase. If I have a Z and I want to apply a Hadamard, it's easy enough, I go to HZ. If I want to apply a controlled Z, and let's say it's not going through any Hadamards, that's also easy, that's just toggling an edge in the graph. But if it does want to go through a Hadamard and it turns into a controlled X, this is normally where some graph-based simulation methods I've seen get stuck. And I've definitely seen one paper, I forget who I believe, Vandenest et al., I think, are the authors, where they do explain how to do it, but the solution is long, intricate, goes into cases and subcases and sub-subcases. And in a paper with Kevin Wren, one that is linked at the beginning, we found an elegant and general way to apply this in the case, general case. So I'll be happy to answer even more details on that at the end. Okay.
Sorry, can I ask one follow-up?
Of course.
If I apply a Hadamard gate to a high-numbered qubit,
yep.
then like with a normal stabilizer formalism, a Hadamard gate, you know, costs some, like it should be linear time. Or
yes,
something.
It is linear.
But you know, in this case, now I might have to rejig the normal form, and could that add another linear cost or something?
Oh yes, in the
so could it be,
like
is it quadratic?
It is quadratic, yes.
Quadratic for each local gate.
You can probably construct an adversarial circuit where, if you don't do any pre-computation on your circuit, like removing pairs of Hadamards, that you can punish the time to basically quadratic per gate. But the average case, I believe, is about the same. I might be wrong. It is true that actually in the stabilizer case, the average case is just linear per gate. So I guess that's another upside I can add to the stabilizer box. Yes.
So could there be any large, like, so the stabilizer formalism lets you efficiently simulate Clifford circuits. Could there be some larger class of circuits or other class of circuits that the ZX calculus lets you efficiently simulate?
That is a wonderful question. That is, I guess, one of the directions that I'm excited to explore further. Our canonical form results are for Clifford things only. But one of the very neat things about this thing is, about ZX calculus in particular, is that, well, for example, we know that we can get universal quantum computation if we use the T gate, or the pi over 8 gate. And the pi over 8 gate is very, very easy to do in ZX calculus. Just, you know, instead of this pi over 2 here, we just have a pi over 4, because the T gate is ket 0, bra 0, plus e to the I pi over 4. Great. So insofar as simplifying the ZX diagram using the rules that were there at the start, you can do some simulation with it. There, at the end of the talk, I'm happy to give further details on how you can do some simplifications sort of in the middle. But I think to go to a polynomial size canonical form or something like that for a circuit, for a higher level circuit that involves, let's say, T gates, might be difficult. I think if you had a bound on the number of T gates that you had, then you could probably get some results there. But
it could be outside of the paradigm of how many T gates I have. Like there's like match gate circuits, for instance, that are they're efficiently simulatable, but they're not cliffered, and there's some representation that kind of captures them. So like anyway, so it could just be. I mean, yeah, of course, when you throw in T gates, like you're gonna be universal, and then you're not going to efficiently simulate it.
Right.
There could be some intermediate.
I believe that there is work done on this. This is further outside of what I've done. So I can't comment to anything that I've done regarding that sort of stuff. But there are, I know, certain families of gates that people like looking at with ZX calculus specifically that kind of like apply a phase, but in a particular way that I expect is not Clifford, and but still interacts nicely with other adjacent versions of that gate. So I think that has been looked at, just not by me. And I don't think I can give you more details on that. Okay. Anyone else? Great. So I did start out, you know, promising stuff about quantum codes. And so far, I've only talked about states and circuits. And these are very much not the same thing. So the definition of a quantum code to some people is that it is a set of code words. Importantly, this is very different from a circuit. Or another, you know, a Clifford code, I guess I should have said Clifford code, is a stabilizer tableau. That's sort of an equivalent definition to others. And I want to highlight one of the things that I swept under the rug when I put up the slide at the start of the talk with Ron, Harry, and Hermione. It's that the answers produced by the students are actually different objects. Because the version with the state, the bras and the kets, or the Ron solution, and the circuit that Harry produced, those both take an opinion on what logical zero should be in the short code and what logical one should be. Whereas the stabilizer presentation has no opinion on this. If you write down the stabilizer tableau for the short code, it doesn't actually care about which one is logical zero and which one is logical one. You could like swap those two, and the stabilizer tableau does not care. So in this sense, that makes it a much more natural definition for a code, because if you do care about what is logical zero and what is logical one, then instead you have something much like a circuit. So that is what I mean by when I say a code is a set of code words. Like it's just the bag of code words, you don't really care which is which. So this is another way of putting this, is that applying arbitrary unitary operations to the input nodes of your circuit that is doing the encoding does nothing. It's just still the same code. We want to think about a code as kind of like a circuit, but where we want to look at sort of under the equivalence class of applying input operations doesn't do anything. So can we find a canonical form for this object? So, you know, big drum roll. And the main result that I want to actually share today is that yes, we can. Codes have a canonical form. This canonical form is built using ZX calculus and only four very, very simple rules, much of which we have already seen in the graph construction. So the edge rule is that we have one Z node, so that's a green node, per free edge. So that's input or output. So the free edges are the ones that are like either inputs or outputs that are connected to a node only on one side. And every internal edge in the graph is going to be Hadamarded. So we're going to have some input nodes. Those are going to be connected to some input edges. We're going to have some output nodes. Those are going to be connected to some output edges. In between those, we're going to have some other edges. And all the internal edges are going to be Hadamarded. That's the edge rule. The Hadamard rule. No Hadamard output node. So if you have an output that has a Hadamard local operation on it, so the output edge is blue, is going to be connected to a lower numbered node or input node. This is sort of a slight addendum on the rule from before for graphs, where I said no Hadamard gates on vertices connected to lower numbered nodes. Here we're basically saying, and all the inputs are sort of lower numbered as well, no connecting to those. So no Hadamard gates on the output nodes, connected to the inputs. They can be connected to higher numbered output nodes. That's still fine, just not to the inputs. The RREF rule. The adjacency matrix, this is probably the trickiest rule. The adjacency matrix from the inputs to the outputs must be in row reduced echelon form. So I don't mean the adjacency matrix for the whole picture. I mean specifically from the inputs to the outputs. So we have sort of a set of inputs, we have a set of outputs. So here's an example. Suppose we have 3 inputs and 5 outputs. This is a matrix in row reduced echelon form. It's a binary adjacency matrix. We can apply row operations at will. So this is kind of a consequence of this rule. When we have a code like this, we are welcome to apply any row operations. Like one easy one, for example, is that if we swap 2 inputs, that's just a unitary operation on the inputs, and so that doesn't actually change the codes. And so indeed, we can just swap 2 rows. Seeing why we can add one row to another row is a little bit trickier, but we can also do that. So that means we are welcome to row reduce this matrix, and so once we get it in row reduced echelon form, we say, great, we're done. And we say that the columns that look like the columns of the adjacency matrix are going to be the pivot columns. In this example, this specific example, those are columns 1, 2, and 4. So I am defining this because it is used in the Clifford rule, which is no operations, that includes edges, on the input nodes or on the pivot nodes. So we are not allowed to have an edge between a pivot and another pivot, or any local operation on the output edge, like the S's or HZ's from before on the pivot nodes. They must all have the identity operation on the output edge. Any questions about these rules?
Yeah. So in this example, so like I have initial state of 3 qubits and the output is 5 qubits.
Yeah, not a very good code, but certainly one that you could do. Yeah.
And like.
Perhaps I should draw this one. Maybe that would help. Great. So I would have 3 inputs and 5 outputs. And I want to say that the RREF rule does not have any opinions about the edges among these 5 edges, edges in between these 5 nodes here. It is only talking about the nodes between the inputs and the outputs. In this case, it says that there's an edge from 1 to 1, and then from 1 to 3, from 2 to 2, 2 to 3, and 2 to 5, and from 3 to 4. So as an example, if I had this blue edge, let's say here, I could use my various rewrite rules to eventually say that using, I can do row reduction. So I can take sort of the row corresponding to this node and subtract it, or add it because it's binary, from this one, canceling out this edge. So I can have edges amongst these 5 nodes here, except that the Clifford rule. Yeah, sorry, yeah, yeah.
These edges all include Hadamard,
yeah? I'm sorry? All internal edges, all of them, are going to be Hadamarded.
I see.
So that's why I'm drawing them all the internal ones dashed. The color is merely the chalk I had available. That's not meant to represent anything. So this edge here, for example, is acceptable. That edge is fine. But this edge is not acceptable because that is between nodes 1 and 2. And those are both pivots. Perhaps it would be better if I showed a non-example. Here is a way to violate all of the rules. So now that it's up on the big screen. So this here violates the edge rule, because this is an internal edge that is not Hadamarded. That's no good. This also violates the edge rule, because I'm supposed to have 1 node per free edge. If I have fewer, especially among the inputs. So I can occasionally have fewer among the outputs if I do some trivial simplifications at the end. But among the inputs, that's a definite no-no, because there are various things that I can apply here, and this node sort of compresses them down and loses the information for them. It's not a full code. Okay. Edge number 2, the Hadamard rule. This is a Hadamard on an output that is connected to a lower numbered node. right? This 2 is connected to this 1. No Hadamards on outputs connected to lower numbered node. This one is also in violation of this rule. It gets connected to the inputs, and all the inputs are considered lower numbered. Over here, we see that node 1 is the pivot. And so this edge here is in violation of the RREF rule, because I could sort of subtract the row corresponding to this input from the row corresponding to this input and get rid of this edge. And the Clifford rule is violated in several places. Once is here, no Clifford operations on the input nodes. Right? So I can't have any edges between the inputs. I can't have an S gate on one of the inputs. Or like, I guess this is on the sort of edge connected to the input. This one is also a violation of the Clifford rule, assuming that these are sort of the only two connections from this input, and it's not connected to anything in between this dot, dot, dot. Because after I satisfy the RREF rule and remove this edge, if this is the only edge coming out of this input, this becomes the pivot node. And I can't have local operations on the pivots, including this Hadamard gate. Does that make sense? Does that answer your questions? Great. Wonderful. So this is the slide with all the math. I promise there's just one. Yeah.
So the statement is that any stabilizer code can be represented in this way?
That's right. And in fact, that there is a unique canonical form for any stabilizer code representing it this way. I will have examples in a moment in case you want to see some examples.
How do I create, looking at this, how do I create a Y operator, for instance?
A Y operator?
Yeah.
Well, when you say a Y operator, are you thinking about it? You're building a circuit and you want to have a Y? I see. We have until 4, just to make sure, right? I believe we have until 4. Just want to make sure that. I thought it said 4 in the schedule.
Can I go a few minutes? Can I go a few minutes past?
Yeah, because we started kind of late, so I think it's fine.
Okay.
Usually 1 hour, yeah.
All right, I understand. I'm not going to talk for another half hour. I left plenty of time for questions. To answer your question a little briefly, with Clifford states, with graph states specifically, with graph states, every node has an associated stabilizer, which is an X on that node and a Z on all the neighbors. So if I just apply an X to a node of a graph state, that it's the same as applying a Z to all the neighbors. So if I want to apply a Y to a graph state, I apply an X on that node, which is a Z on all the neighbors, and then a Z. And this allows me to apply a Z on all the nodes by just putting pies. So does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Wonderful. Great. OK. So I'm not going to go through the details of this math, I promise. But in case anyone is curious, it is here. So there is a sort of a, in quotes, well-known calculation, which is the number of tableaus with k stabilizers and n qubits. So what I'm not about to do is I'm not about to prove that I can use operations to, let me make this slide visible for your picture, is to prove that I can get any code into such a canonical form. I can, but that's a story for another day. What I'm instead going to prove is that given that I can do that, the canonical form is unique. And I'm simply going to do this by counting. If I can get every single code into a canonical form, and if the number of canonical forms is the same as the number of codes, I win. Each code has one. And so all we got to do is count them. So this is the number of stabilizers this is the number of tableaus with k stabilizers and n qubits. The approximate places from where these numbers come from is I have 2 choices for a sign, I have 4 of the n choices for my polys, I divide this by all of the constraints that I have to commute with all the previous things that I chose, I subtract the things that are linearly dependent with the things I previously chose, I divide by the overcounting, which is computed in a similar fashion. The number of canonical forms is a much uglier formula. At the end of the day, it's the same formula, but to prove it, to count it, I found this is the method that I found. So it is a double recursion that has these two terms, A and B. And I have these two extra parameters here, P and O. And I think of these as pivot nodes and output nodes. Or when I say output nodes, I really mean non-pivot output nodes. I didn't want to call it N for obvious reasons. And I start with sort of the 0-0 case where none of my nodes are like assigned as pivots or outputs. I have N nodes among the outputs, and I need to assign them, pivot or non-pivot. And if I assign a node to be a pivot, then the only choices that I have are which of the previous O output nodes I can connect it to. But I have no choices amongst what else I can connect it to. I can't put any local operations on it. I can't connect it to any inputs other than its like next corresponding input, basically. And I can't connect it to other pivots. So that term is easy enough. This term is what I get if I decide to make a node a non-pivot node. I have various choices of sign. In particular, if I am not putting any Hadamards on it, then I can connect it to any of the previous P inputs, any of the previous P pivots. There are as many previous sort of inputs and pivots as have been assigned. I can't connect it to the later inputs because then it would become its pivot node. And I said it's not a pivot node. And this plus two, this one, the first plus two in the exponent, comes from the fact that if I'm choosing a non-Hadamard output operation, then I have four choices, which are the four on the left of that slide with the six output operations. Okay, and so if I just do that, then I stare at this recursion for a very long time and eventually figure out that it solves to this, which is a big mess, but it does satisfy the recurrence relation. And if I plug in P equals O equals zero, I get this, which is the same as the number of tableaus. And so that completes the proof. With the fact that each code can be transformed into a canonical form. So therefore, canonical form is unique. And so now, the big moment that we were waiting for is some examples of codes in their canonical form. So, building up to it, the 5-qubit code looks like this. A lot nicer than the bras and the kets that we saw on that slide near the start of the talk. Here, we can very clearly see the fact that all 5 qubits in the 5-qubit code play exactly the same role. They're all like equally important. They're all connected to the input. They're all connected to their neighbors. That's it. The entanglement structure, this nebulous term that I've been alluding to, is, I think, also a lot more clear in this type of presentation. The 7-qubit code looks like the vertices of a Boolean cube. And this also comes through in its code. You can sort of see the cube in there. Here, I did not align all the vertices on the right to showcase this structure, but it is there. Furthermore, the edges on the right are not in the most traditional order in which they are for the 7-qubit code. But again, that's a minor detail. I want to highlight the cube structure that exists in the code. And now, the ZX solution to the question that we asked at the beginning, which is depicting Shor's 9-qubit code, is just this. It is so simple, so elegant. It has so few nodes. We can immediately see why nodes 1, 2, and 3 are the same. Nodes 4, 5, and 6 are the same. Nodes 7, 8, and 9. And we can see that those three clumps of nodes are indeed the same as each other. It has slightly fewer nodes on the right than 9 because we can have some nodes that are sort of connected by Hadamards and only have two incident edges and can be removed. But it can be simplified to this. And I think that that is very beautiful. So hopefully, this convinces your mind to change the language with which we used to think about ZX calculus. So thank you very much. Yeah.
Where's the Torii code?
Yeah, we have done that in our work with Alex Lee, so that's still being worked on. So the Torii code has there's a slight kind of issue if you want to get a very beautiful picture. And it is the fact that in the canonical form, I say you cannot have an H be connected to a lower numbered node. And so that demands a numbering of the nodes. But a torus doesn't really have a start or end or a natural place to start numbering and finish numbering the nodes. So you have to sort of like, cut open the torus and make it into a sheet. And so this creates edge effects that are not super pretty if you follow the canonical form to the letter. However, just by moving the edges that have the Hadamards around very slightly, we were able to create a very pretty picture for the Torii code, one that does look nice and symmetric. It conveys why One thing it doesn't do super well is convey why the Torah code is symmetric in one of the two directions, but it does it for the other one. Because again, you have to sort of cut it open, so, and it's not phenomenal. There is other work in ZX calculus that works very well in the case of CSS codes, which the Torah code is an example of, where it uses more nodes. This is work by Alex Kissinger. It uses more nodes, but way fewer edges to express the stabilizers almost directly in the ZX language. So that requires basically kind of like qubit nodes and like check nodes, effectively. And so we get rid of all the check nodes, moving everything into the edges at the cost of creating a whole lot more edges. But yes, we can do it. No, it's not super pretty because you have to cut it open. I think I saw that hand go up like a millisecond before yours.
Does it also help you see how to decode, like another benefit of this?
So there are definitely parts of this that. So for the Torah code in particular, I think the answer is we're still looking at it. For a code like this one, so. One thing that is fairly clear is, like, suppose I encounter a Z operation. A Z operation is a green node with a pi. If any of these green node output edges experiences a green node with a pi, that pi gets bloop merged into the corresponding one of these three green nodes. And it's pretty clear the correction operation is just, you know, a green node with a pi on each any one of those edges. For X nodes, it's a little bit trickier. But that is one of the why I emphasize this upside of the stabilizer presentation is that it gives you the recovery map and the syndromes very nicely. This does not do that as immediately on its surface. Yeah?
Can it do a generalization to Q-dit case?
There is a Q-dit ZX calculus. And I have not worked with it much. Now, I know a few things about this. It's that usually, you will have a node will have two phases. It'll have two parameters. It'll be sort of split into an alpha and a beta. I know that the Q-trit, for example, version of the Hadamard operator now like permutes your bases or something like that instead of just swapping them. So it no longer becomes its own inverse. And I don't even actually really know what error-correcting codes for Q-trits really look like, even without touching ZX calculus. Maybe way down the line that is sort of in store, but I haven't really worked with the Q-dit ZX calculus as much.
So can I ask one?
Yeah, of course.
Does it always generate this kind of tree tensor network, or it could have some loops?
Well, here are loops, and there are more loops here. So there's definitely loops. But one thing that I think is not yet super clear is some people asked me about equivalent codes. So very briefly, like if I have a code and I swap the order of two of my outputs. Now, of course, that's the same code, really. Like the order of my outputs doesn't really matter. It doesn't convey anything, especially if the person receiving it knows that I did this. Like it still has the same threshold, rate, whatever, NKD, you know, all that stuff. And a very similar thing is true if I apply a local operation to one of my outputs. If I apply an entangling operation, a lot of these things fall apart. But if I just like apply an S to one of my outputs, and I assume I have random poly noise, then suddenly it becomes like the same code, right? Because random poly, you know, times any local operation is still just another random poly. So one interesting question, I think, is what is a canonical form for a equivalence class of codes where we're taking codes to be equivalent if under this definition that I talked about, like up to permutations and local operations. Or maybe those can be handled separately. But and maybe, I'm not 100% sure, maybe those don't have loops. They probably do, but there's some chance they don't.
A more general question. Are there any like application-driven motivations that you see for using this representation of codes?
Well, I mean, I think that it is a lot easier to work with and talk about. And of course, every presentation has its drawbacks. And I think that, like, I am not so convinced that the stabilizer presentation is like far superior to this one. So I think it is very reasonable to work with this way. As one thing that I've been thinking about occasionally is that when thinking about the practical realities of building a code, you care about locality a lot. It matters to you which qubits are physically near which other qubits because you need to apply some transversal gates. And so if you can see where those transversal gates are going to need to be applied, and you know which qubits need to be next to which other qubits, like for example, you know, I think this is the natural thing to look at for this, or even this one really. Like, you know, this input is not interacting with this output at all. Like they don't have to be anywhere close to each other. They're sort of like three steps at the shortest before you even get there. I think this allows you to figure that sort of thing out. So that's one of the applications that I see for this. Apart from just massively simplifying how we think of and communicate about and even potentially teach quantum codes.
Thank you.
So I guess since we have gone over the time, let's end for now and then maybe interested people can stay. So let's thank the speaker.